You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 21st, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me, as always, are Bob Novella. Hey, everybody. Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy Apple Day, everyone.
Apple Day.
It is Apple Day. Celebrated mainly in the United Kingdom.
In the United Kingdom, because Apple is a very American kind of thing.
As American as apple
pie.
You
think so, right? Apple pie.
Johnny Appleseed. Yeah.
Apple Day. Celebration of apples and orchards.
Any particular kind of apple, or is it just any kind of apple?
Well, I mean, anything having to do with apples. It can be large or small apples, apple games they play in gardens, juices and ciders are made.
Evan, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
How do you like them apples?
That was good, Steve.
If you wanted something a little more scientific.
Always.
October 23rd. Do you know what October 23rd is? Well, Mole Day is October 23rd. It's celebrated amongst chemists in North America between 6.02 a.m. and 6.02 p.m.
Ah.
Now, 6.02 on October 23rd. Have you put it all together yet? Have you figured
it
out?
Yeah, 6.02 to the 23rd power is Avogadro's number.
There you go. Yay. Defining the number of particles in a mole. And there you have it. So how do you like them apples?
Awesome. So Rebecca is still traveling around the Orient, but we will actually get a report from her later on in the program. We also, I should say, have an interview coming up with James Randi.
Woohoo!
First, a couple news items. Apparently, the universe is trying to destroy the Large Hadron Collider from the future!
Huh?
Right.
Yeah, this is one of the wackier...
That article was ridiculous.
It was pretty bizarre. But remember last year, they were talking about the LHC and how that it was going to create black holes or strange matter, it's going to destroy the Earth. Well, now we got two scientists that are basically they're saying that we have nothing to worry about because influences from the future apparently are propagating back in time to sabotage the LHC, preventing the creation of any dangerous particles, kind of like a Terminator for Higgs particles. If you forget about all this LHC stuff, LHC, Large Hadron Collider, is a super collider created by CERN and scientists all over the world for the past 15 years and more than $9 billion. It's the biggest physics experiment ever built, and when fully operational, will hurl subatomic particles like protons around and around an 18-mile underground tunnel at energies of 7 trillion electron volts. And then they smash them together and they check out the debris and hope that it's interesting. And one of the things that they hope is among this debris will be this the so-called Higgs boson, also known as the God particle, which is hypothesized to imbue all of matter with mass. Now, the LHC was supposed to be boot up last year. Remember last year?
Yep.
Was it like August? Was day? We're all like psyched.
Had a little leak.
But they had a problem called the magnetic quench, which is just the abnormal termination of a magnet operation. The quench actually melted the connection between two of their giant magnets and also explosively released some liquid helium. And that was just, unfortunately, one of the many delays and problems with the LHC. In fact, it's now more than 2.5 years late for when it was supposed to originally be fully operational, at least according to a CERN 2005 annual report prediction.
But now this station is fully operational.
It's getting there. They hope now is that it will be operational in about 5 weeks or so. But you would think that delays like this would be kind of normal, right, for such an incredibly complex instrument.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, look at the delays and problems for the International Space Station or any number of science projects.
Our website was delayed that much.
Good point.
hey,
point,
whoa.
Right? But now you got these scientists Holger Beck Nielsen of the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen and Masao Ninomiya at the of the Yukawa Institute for Theoretical Physics in Kyoto, Japan. They're saying that they can mathematically prove that nature will somehow ripple backwards through time to stop the LHC before it can create the God particle. Dr. Nielsen recently said that it must be our prediction that all Higgs-producing machines shall have bad luck.
Luck? Wait a minute. Is that a scientific term in the Niels Bohr Institute? Or something? I'm I'm really at a loss.
Yeah, bad
that.
Luck. They've quantified bad luck, apparently.
I want to hear about other scientists' reactions to this. I mean, this is really them tipping their hand that they are unscientific.
Well, yeah, you're right. I tried to find some scientists' reactions. I found one, and it really helped me kind of figure out what was going on here. But the other interesting thing that they talk about is that they said that they could test their hypothesis, which is always a great sign. When a scientist says that here's a test, that's really good. But their test is that basically you would shuffle a virtual million card deck of cards in which all but one say something like do the experiment, and only one out of a million says don't do the experiment. So what they propose is that you randomly pick a card, and they believe that by picking the no experiment, the very rare no experiment card, could be one of the ways that the universe manifests its bias for a no Higgs universe.
I totally don't get any of what you just said. I don't get it.
But wait, no. One more point, though. The hard part, though, is that you would have to really mean it. The scientists at CERN would have to really mean it when they say that they would do whatever the card said.
They have to take a 1 in a million chance that they do not do.
Which is ridiculous, of course, because there's no way that they're going to test these wacky ideas and roll the dice on something like that. It's just crazy that. So it's really a non-test.
But do you think, Bob, that these guys, this is kind of a tongue-in-cheek thought experiment? Are they serious? Like, first of all, you always have to say these guys could be being quoted out of context and not being represented fairly. You know, in this Fox News report, Dr. Nielsen is quoted as saying, "One could almost say that we have a model for God. He rather hates Higgs particles and attempts to avoid them." I mean, those kind of statements sound to me like they're not taking this that seriously.
Yeah, you know, the impression I got, I've read a bunch of news items about it, and I never really got the impression that this is a tongue-in-cheek thing. I think they really believe this. That's my impression. My reaction to this, just initially after just reading it, was that it made no sense. That doesn't the Higgs boson already need to exist for this to be true? So, you know, and so it's kind of bizarre, because if you create a Higgs boson, then the theory is correct, and the Higgs field permeating the universe gives mass to everything. You know, maybe the problem is not creating the Higgs, but actually the discovery itself.
Yeah, just us knowing about it.
Right, there's some bias, some universal bias against actually, you know, discovering it and absolutely proving it, which is weird and kind of silly.
Yeah, but then you could start getting into all sorts of weird philosophical questions, like, is there an actual difference with empirically knowing something or just believing in it? Like, what if we lied to a scientist and said we proved the Higgs, and then that person actually believes that we empirically know it? What's the difference? It's ridiculous.
It really is. But if you want a more technical objection, I try to dig into some of the technical objections that at least one scientist has. This is Sean Carroll from Discovery's blog called Cosmic Variance. But one big technical objection that makes a lot of sense is that these scientists are using are you guys familiar with imaginary numbers?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Square root of minus one.
Yeah.
Right. They really make no sense, because how could you take the square of negative one? I mean, it really makes no sense. But clearly it works in math and in physics. It's a valuable concept. And it works. There's clearly tremendous value from this concept. But the idea that there could be a physical manifestation of an imaginary number, or the way these scientists, they actually use an imaginary component to some of their theories, to the action, which is a physics principle. So they're throwing in an imaginary component in there, which to me is, I'm very uncomfortable with doing that. And the scientists themselves, here's a great quote regarding this whole idea. The scientists themselves said the following: "Our model with an imaginary part of the action begins with a series of not completely convincing but still suggestive assumptions." So clearly the genesis of this whole idea is incredibly speculative.
Okay, maybe they're just really speculating wildly. Or again, you could think of this as, like we talked recently about, the epidemiology of the zombie apocalypse, right? Where you start with a kind of a wacky, fantastical idea, but then you proceed in a very rigorous scientific manner from that point forward, again, to its logical conclusion. So they're saying, what if the universe is trying to keep us from discovering the Higgs particle?
Right.
You know? then go from there. But starting with crazy sort of ends the game,
right?
Pretty much.
But who knows what?
Unless they turn out to be right, in which case they'll be fucking
right.
Geniuses.
Yeah,
that's a Nobel Prize. But I don't think I don't think CERN's going to do the test. So they got to come up with another test.
Yeah, it's also proposing a sort of a solution to a non-problem. It's like, why is the LHC having so many problems? Because it's freaking complicated.
Right.
We don't need to propose time-traveling Higgs particles or whatever to figure out why the LHC is having delays. It's having delays because it's a complicated piece of
exactly.
machine.
Here's what this article reminded me of. When the Hubble first went up, remember it was out of focus and the first pictures came back all fuzzy and stuff?
The Hubble hubbub.
Spherical aberration.
I tried looking it up online and I couldn't find an article. I recall reading an article in the early 90s when this happened. Someone was claiming that because the Hubble was going to peer into the, you know, into the earliest moments of time and so forth, and this was somehow God's hand in it, that he does not want you to see what creation was like back at the early time. So he made an argument effectively that, you know, this is basically, you know, God is interfering and God has made the Hubble telescope be out of focus. And, you know, that kind of smacked me in a similar way, this story and that one many, many years ago.
Well, let's go on to something a little bit more down to earth. Recent study published in the journal Complementary Therapies in Medicine compared the effectiveness of copper bracelets, two different kinds of magnetic bracelets, and then a demagnetized control bracelet in the treatment of osteoarthritis. And guess what they found? Zero difference. No difference.
What they found consistent among all people who bought these things was that their wallets were lighter to about the same degree.
Right. This is actually a crossover study. So they had 45 people wear each of the four bracelets for 6 weeks each and then rate their pain. And there was no difference. You know, interestingly, what I didn't realize is that this is actually only the second study looking at copper bracelets for arthritis.
Really?
I did a PubMed search on copper bracelets, and actually there was just two studies, this one and the one from 1976. That's it. Everything else was just commentary or review. The one in 1976 said it showed, quote-unquote, some benefit, but nothing dramatic. This one, dead negative. Not surprising. There really isn't much prior plausibility to the copper bracelet thing for arthritis. There are more studies with the magnetic bracelets, and this literature is more noisy. But you know what the big problem is with studying magnetic bracelets in a double-blind manner?
It's easy to test. Whether you have it or not,
it's really hard to blind them. Right?
Yeah.
You know, you reach into your pocketbook for your keys, and you'll find out if that bracelet is magnetic or not. So that's sort of hampered these studies. And so there's more, you know, sort of weakly positive studies with the magnetic stuff, whether bracelets or braces or whatever. There was one study I found that where it looked at magnetic bracelets for knee and hip pain. So it's not even near the part of the body that's supposed to be benefit. And that showed a positive effect. To me, that says that's a false positive, right? I mean, there's just no plausibility there. You know, wearing a bracelet is going to help your knee pain. So that just shows sort of, I think, the problem in blinding these studies, and that you're just measuring placebo effects. But in any case, if you put that aside, if you just look at the literature at face value, there have been a number of systematic reviews which essentially show no effect, right? That there's insufficient evidence to say that this is effective for anything. So even with the more noisy magnetic literature, the evidence is not there. So again, so the findings of this most recent study are not surprising. Interestingly, you know, I think I'll discuss this before, so I'll just quickly summarize. A number of mechanisms have been proposed for how magnetic insoles or braces or bracelets or whatever can work, and none of them have really panned out, and most of them don't make any sense if you think about them even a little bit. So magnets do not increase blood flow. They do not attract the iron in your blood, which is non-ferromagnetic to begin with. It doesn't reduce inflammation. It doesn't, you know, increase oxygen delivery. It really doesn't have any measurable physiological effect. One thing that confuses a lot of people is that there are some studies looking at dynamic magnets, right? And like really powerful dynamic magnets that actually have a measurable field at tissue depth showing some physiological response. And they say, see, that's a proof of principle. It actually isn't, because most of these products are static magnets. And the static magnetic field shouldn't have any physiological effect, and it really can't compare it to an alternating or a dynamic magnetic field. And also the strength of the static magnetic fields that are being used is very, very shallow. In other words, they drop off very, very quickly, so it doesn't get to tissue depth, you know? Also, you know, often it's brought up that if magnetic fields had such a powerful effect on biological function, then we would probably would notice something when we put people in a 2 Tesla magnet for an MRI scan, right. You know? But there really isn't any, other than the images that we get, you know, there's really no physiological effect from being in that massively powerful magnet. So forget about the tiny little refrigerator magnets that people are strapping to their knees or wrists or whatever. So bottom line, don't waste your money on copper or magnetic bracelets for pain or arthritis or whatever.
Well, you could get the Q-Ray. They have an entry model for $59.95 you can get. Or you can get their Rose Gold Deluxe for $200.
Are they still allowed to sell that stuff? I thought they were shut down.
Yeah, the FTC's already gone after them. I mean, they've actually had judgments made against them by the FTC for fraud, essentially, or false advertising.
You know, when Perry was in the hospital one time and I went to get him something at the gift shop before I went up and visited him, and sure enough, right there in the display case, magnetic bracelet, good for what ails you, bought it for him, brought it up to him. We both had a very good laugh over that one.
That's crazy.
So I was just poking around the Q-Ray site trying to find some BS on there, and apparently they must have taken it all off because of the trouble that they got in. So so I went to the Why Q-Ray link. And the quick response was, it says, why not? For almost 20 years, Q-Ray has been recognized as the world leader in wellness lifestyle bracelets.
Wellness lifestyle, yes. Yeah, so they're selling a lifestyle, not an actual cure or anything. Yeah, that's just the way they get around the regulations. Evan, give us the quick skinny on the balloon boy.
Yeah, so was anyone around on Friday when this was all?
Was anyone not glued?
You had to be in a cave,
basically.
Was
anyone not glued?
Yeah.
It's either their television or radio or what have you. I mean, this thing dominated October 16th, in which supposedly a homemade balloon crafted by the Henney family of Colorado got loose from its tethers, and apparently inside the balloon was, they believed, their 6-year-old son Falcon, who somehow got in there. And there it was, this balloon supposedly zipping away. with a UFO shaped balloon. Exactly. With a 6-year-old boy, you know, inside. So, you know, obviously everyone's, you know, the immediate concern obviously was for the child. And that was the reason why this gained.
That's the Jimmy's falling down a well media attention.
Exactly. As you all know, the boy was not in the balloon as it came down several hours later in a field, and there was nothing inside this in the balloon. But where was the
balloon? Well, actually, didn't the bottom had fallen off?
There was
off
a box.
The
there was something attached to the bottom.
Yeah, the box detached from the balloon.
Although by the time they had the cameras and everything on it, apparently the box had already detached. So what you have is this, you know, balloon floating away. So this balloon chase ensued for 3 hours. No boy was to be found inside. Where was the boy? Well, it turns out the boy was home. He was hiding in the attic. You know, he didn't come, according to the father, Richard Henney, he didn't come out because he was afraid that he was, you know, going to get punished for playing with the family balloon or something to that effect. Well, what it turned out is a little more investigation by police into the matter, and this was a hoax designed by Richard and Mayumi Henney, who are no strangers to television. They have appeared before on a television show called Wife Swap, which is a reality-based television show. This fellow, Richard Henney, is big into UFO conspiracies, big into alien conspiracies.
Yeah, so this is all a publicity stunt to try to, you know, help them get their own reality TV show. But I wonder if what happened was that the hoax went awry when the box detached from the balloon, so then they couldn't pretend that the kid was in there anymore, right? But he would have fallen to his death if he were in there. So that kind of blew a hole in their story.
Yeah, I also read though that somebody looked at the balloon and said that it never could have lifted the kid's weight anyway.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but most people watching it on the TV wouldn't know that.
No, but as the cameras were following this balloon, kind of, you know, going at a pretty good clip through the air, you can tell that thing is, you know, speeding by at a decent clip. It seemed highly improbable that there was anything in that balloon. There was no bulge. There was no, mm-hmm. you know, sign of any kind of movement or any object. A rock didn't matter, right? That there was no weight to it. And then they started to tell you about what the approximate dimensions of this balloon were, and you know, people started to figure it out as people. I was listening to the radio for the most part as this was developing, and they had people calling in saying, "There's no way anything is on that balloon. It's too small. It doesn't have enough. You know, it could maybe lift a pound or two, maybe at most." The kid was 37 pounds.
I think you know, the press of, you know, eventually, and certainly the investigators were pretty much on top of it. You know, I can't really fault the press for the way the story was reported.
This fellow, Richard Henney, had a video up on YouTube. Actually, he had a series of videos up on YouTube, all about his beliefs about, you know, aliens, UFOs, life on Mars, a bunch of other things. They've all been taken down now. But at one point, and there was a link on the Drudge Report to it. It was the title was "Fake or Real? Hillary Clinton is a Reptilian." Are you guys familiar with the whole theory about, you know, how the reptilians are alien invaders, and they've infiltrated all the highest levels of government around the world, and we're really all being from the government standpoint, controlled by these aliens that are actually in control? So I actually got a chance to glimpse at that. I mean, this guy is really not all there.
Yeah, I never watched that show Wife Swap, but I think it was on one time or twice I saw it, and that was one of the episodes I happened to see. It was disgusting because that episode was sold as, you know, because they try to get like opposites to swap wives and see what happens. That was sold as like the true believers versus the scientist, and this guy was the scientist. I'm like, oh my goodness, this guy's a total crank. But to these morons, he's a scientist.
I know, but Steve, you're watching Wife Swap, you know?
Well, still.
Yeah, I know. Well, Bob, you're going to give us a very quick update on the lunar plume that NASA didn't see when they crashed the La Crosse satellite into the lunar surface.
Yeah, finally they got some good news for the La Crosse mission that hurled, if you remember, it hurled an empty rocket stage into the moon looking for water. If you remember, everyone was hoping for dramatic images of a plume of debris or ejecta rising above the moon. That plume seemed to be a no-show, which was disappointing to many people who got up early in the morning to visit the site and look at the big video screen that NASA put up. And lots of people, I even know somebody who has a decent-sized telescope, and she was up looking early trying to see something, and they didn't see anything. So a lot of people were very disappointed, even though good science and the discovery of water was still possible. It just didn't live up to the hype that NASA made of it. Well, it seems now that the Shepard satellite that was monitoring the whole thing and actually plunged into the moon 4 minutes later, after the main impact, did in fact detect a plume of debris rising above the surface of the moon, but it was very small, as you might imagine. It wasn't the 10-kilometer high plume that they had hoped. It was only less than a mile or less than a kilometer or so. And the reason I didn't know this previously as well. The reason why they think now that it might have been such a small plume was a combination of things. One was the hollow booster rocket. When something hollow hits something really hard, it does less damage because it crumples like a car, like modern cars do nowadays. So you had this booster rocket that kind of absorbed all the impact, and when it crumpled up, and the actual surface of the moon was, they think, that area was kind of spongy and energy absorbing as well. So that's kind of like what they're going with now. Now, people from the Earth, like the Hubble and people on Earth, would not have seen this plume at all because it didn't rise above the rim of the crater. So that's why they could never have seen it. So the bottom line is that they finally got the plume, which they were hoping for, and they're still doing good science. The science was never really terribly impacted by any of this. And they're saying now that hopefully that they'll have some good information by mid-November, and hopefully they'll find some of the water.
Awesome. Mm. So a bit of a PR fizzle, but the science still was successful.
Yeah, exactly.
One more quick item before we check in with Rebecca and Randy. This one's in honor of Halloween, which is coming up. Next week will be really the Halloween episode, but just to lead up to that, researchers have discovered the largest orb weaver spider ever. It's a spider. It lives in Africa and Madagascar. It is called Naphila komachi, K-O-M-A-C-I, named after a colleague of the discoverer who had unfortunately died in an accident recently. The person who discovered it is Matjaž Kuntner. He's a biologist from Slovenian Academy of Sciences and Arts. And actually, he first found a specimen in 2000, but it was just an isolated specimen, and it was dead. It wasn't actually a living specimen. But then subsequently found several more representatives of the species, so they could say, yes, this is definitely a species. This spider is huge for a spider. Yeah, if you saw this thing crawling around your kitchen, I think you would notice.
So how big is it, Steve?
It's actually not the biggest spider. It's just the biggest orb weaver spider. So its body, just the body itself, is about 1.5 inches. With the leg span is about 4.7 inches. And it weaves webs that are up to a meter or over 3 feet in diameter.
Cool.
Wow.
Love to see that.
Can you imagine that? That'd be enormous. Other thing that's really interesting is the disparity in the size between the female and the male is also...
Sexual dimorphism, they call it?
Yeah, it's immense. It's actually it's a case of female gigantism.
Oh.
So there we go. Biggest orb-weaving spider. So for Halloween, you got to have a meter-wide fake spider's web for decoration.
That's a nasty-looking arachnid.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a pretty one.
No.
Well, let's go on and check in with Rebecca and then Randy. Now we're being joined by Rebecca Watson from Bangkok. Rebecca, how is it in Bangkok?
It's awesome, except for that you guys aren't here.
I know.
But besides that, it's great.
That would be fun.
When are we going to do live podcast of SGU here in Bangkok?
I know. While you're there, your job is to set that up. Do we have any listeners in Bangkok?
I don't know. No one contacted me and said that I should visit them. So either we do and they don't like me very much, or we don't.
Rebecca, I would figure that you would have already started a Skeptics in the Pub Bangkok style going on down there.
Every night wherever I am is Skeptics in the Pub.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been having Skeptics in the Pub Singapore and Malaysia and Bangkok, Phuket.
So Rebecca and I have a funny little story to tell you guys.
Okay.
Let me tell you the story of me getting spammed from Rebecca's Skype account by some random girl named Nana in Malaysia. So I noticed that Rebecca's on Skype, and I said to her, I'm like, hey, you want a boat? Like, last I heard, you were on a boat, Rebecca, so I didn't know where the hell you were. And then Rebecca, quote unquote, Rebecca says hi. And I said, how are you? Where are you? And she goes, Malaysia. So I'm like, cool, how is it? And then from that moment forward, the conversation clearly was not me with Rebecca.
You just sensed it wasn't Rebecca on the other end.
It wasn't Rebecca. It was not Rebecca.
Psychic sense that it wasn't me.
So I figured, okay, somebody hacked into her account. So I start saying weird stuff. So I said to the person, I think I'm going to shoot myself. Good thing you Skyped me. And then the lady responds with, nice, where are you?
Oh.
So I send out Rebecca these crazy emails. I'm like, Rebecca, emergency, emergency. Somebody hacked into your Skype account, and I called her up and everything. So I finally get an email from Rebecca, and she says, no, don't worry. That was me. I was drunk. I was in a cyber cafe, and I accidentally left Skype on, and I left.
Yeah. Oh, it wasn't some mastermind Malaysian hacker.
So just random people were going on your Skype account. And
yeah. I changed the password, though, so it should be fine now.
That's good. Rebecca, you implied that you have had some encounters with the paranormal in Asia.
It's true. We spent a few days on this beautiful island called Langkawi, which is right off the coast of Malaysia. And on our way there, we met this really cool woman on a train, and she was talking to us about the island and what we should see while we were there. And she told us the story of this this woman who was put to death on the island years and years, like centuries ago. The woman apparently became pregnant out of wedlock, and she was accused of adultery. But she claimed that she had become pregnant by some supernatural means. But they didn't believe her, and they put her to death for adultery. But when they put her to death, they were stabbing her with spears, as one might, and she bled white, which apparently showed that she was innocent. Sadly, too late. So she died and cursed the island to have 7 centuries of terrible luck, apparently. But the 7 centuries are up, so it's actually quite a booming little tourist island now. And you can go to see this woman's grave, and you can also see there's a lake called the Lake of the Pregnant Maiden. And supposedly that's where she got magically pregnant. And women who want to get pregnant are encouraged to go there and swim. I did not swim in the lake. So hopefully I will not get magic pregnant.
All right. So they said that if she's innocent, she bleeds white, and she got immaculately conceived.
Well, impregnated.
Well, there impregnated.
There's a line of thought going on here, all right?
That means they killed God.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right? True.
Or she ate a lot of vanilla ice cream before they got to her.
That's sick. Yeah, it's an I thought it was a really interesting story on several levels. Like, I mean, one, the magical impregnation. But the deeper story, I think, is that, you know, they used to put women to death for having children out of wedlock. So who wouldn't say that it was,
right, of course,
it was magical, you know? So, you know, you kind of can't blame her. The whole bleeding white thing, who knows where that part came from. It's almost kind of nice, though, that she became a heroic figure, considering that it was a very anti-woman law that put her to death.
You know, maybe she wasn't lying. I mean, you know, she could have been saying, you know, it was magical. Like, maybe she really enjoyed it, you know?
Well, yeah. and not to bring it down too much, but she also might have been raped. So,
yeah, that's true.
Who knows?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Who knows? It was 700 years ago, right?
Yeah, really. It's hard to do the forensics on that so far afterwards. But then also we went to see a waterfall on the island. It's a really pretty waterfall that's up in a rainforest. And according to our guidebook, fairies have been known to use that as their playground. So we went and we looked, but all we saw were dozens of adorable local children. So
little
maybe
cherubs.
Those fairies, they were very cute. I don't know about them being fairies, though.
Rebecca, when are you coming home?
I will be back in London by next Thursday, I guess, end of October. What's that, the 29th?
Awesome.
So I'm not sure if I can be on the show next week. I might not be home in time.
But definitely the week after that.
After that, yes, definitely.
You'll be home in time for Halloween, though.
I will be back in time for Halloween. Bob, Halloween is not big in London. It's so sad.
Wow, that would be a deal breaker. I wouldn't go.
You know, speaking of British series, do you guys like Red Dwarf?
I'm aware of its existence.
I'm aware of it. I never got into it.
I'm one of the actors on Red Dwarf now his name's Robert Llewellyn. He has he's on TV in England still on different shows, and he has an internet show called Carpool, where he drives around with people and talks to them, basically. And I guess I'm going to be on it
cool.
in early November. So I'll let you guys know when it's up. It'll go online so everybody can see.
Oh, awesome.
Oh, wow.
Wow, that sounds awesome.
Skeptics Guide should get a plug, of course.
Well, Rebecca, we look forward to getting you back from your tour to spread skepticism throughout Asia.
I look forward to being home. As much fun as I'm having, it'll be nice to be back in London.
Enjoy the rest of your trip, Rebecca.
Thank you. Nice talking to you guys.
Bye, Rebecca.
Bye.
Bye.
Joining us now is James Randi. Randi, welcome back to the Skeptics Guide.
It's good to be here, Steve.
And James Randi is one of the few people in the skeptical movement that truly requires no introduction. I think everyone knows quite well who you are, but we'll give the quick overview. James Randi, of course, is a magician and skeptic and promoter of science and reason. He is the chairman of the board of the James Randi Educational Foundation, the author of numerous books, an inveterate skeptic, the founder of course, the JREF and the Amazing Meeting, which has evolved into the annual meeting of the skeptical movement, in my opinion. And it's always a pleasure to have you on our show. So again, welcome back.
I'm blushing here. You can't see it, but I'm blushing. Remember, maybe you can see. Maybe you can see that. See that. See, I never say anything is impossible. I say. I want proof. That's all. So there.
So, Randi, I think the question that everyone has first off is, how are you doing health-wise?
Well, I'll give you an immediate report, an on-scene report. I'm sitting here with a bottle in my pocket under pressure, which is feeding some chemotherapy into a little port on my chest. It's a lot of fun. You know, I feel like the bionic man, but without the $6 million price tag. But I'm doing very well with it. I'm taking chemotherapy at... I've just had my 7th dose of 12 that are scheduled, and so I'll be finished the first week of January. So I'm doing very well. I have no complaints at all. I'm taking the right medications, and I'm taking care of myself and drinking lots of fluids. Oh, gurgle, gurgle. The nausea and such that might accompany this are just absent. I don't know whether it's my pure soul or what it is, but whatever it is, or maybe I'm just so nasty that the poison is... is afraid to offend me. I'm not sure.
Professional courtesy.
Yes. Yes. Very good.
Well, that's great. And the prognosis, I understand, is good.
Oh, yeah. The prognosis is good. And I had the operation, you know. It was colon cancer, and they took out a few inches of my colon. But I've been digesting stuff just the way I always have, because there's yards and yards of it in there, so I can spare it, I'm sure. But they removed that, and then they're giving me the chemo to clear up lymph glands and a few things like that. I decided to cancel my lymph glands altogether. Don't know how to go about it, but...
So you're availing yourself of the best of science-based medicine.
Absolutely, and no beating on drums or prayers or chanting or homeopathic medicine. No, I've managed to escape that. I decided at the last minute, no, I'll go the old-fashioned way. It's called science.
Right.
Oh, no magnets or copper bracelets.
Oh, no copper bracelets, no magnets.
Can I ask you, has anyone from the other side tried to taunt you or offer you any alternative medicine or unscientific treatments? Or they know better?
No, so far they haven't. But Sylvia Brown, I understand, is now claiming that she predicted this.
Is that right?
Yes, indeed. No, it's not right that she did, but it's right that she's claiming
it. It's right that she claims it, yeah. But we don't have that in any writing or anything documented.
No, somebody doubtless after hearing this will send me a raft of things where she says exactly that.
Right. At some point she said, Randi will get sick at some point in the future.
Yes.
Which is, you know.
What are the odds?
Yeah, it's pretty safe prediction about anybody. Yeah.
I had a funny thing happen, Steve. I must share this with you. Jim Mosley is an ex-friend of mine who lives in Florida here, and he publishes a thing called Saucer Smear, which is all about UFOs, and you probably wouldn't have heard of it, but it's a hand-typed thing that he mails out every now and then. He hasn't discovered computers, I guess. And he said out there that I was on death's door, the whole thing, that I was confined to a wheelchair. Steve, I've only been in a wheelchair once in my life, and that was at TAM Las Vegas, this last one. And I was in there just for 2 days because there were long hauls to transverse, and I had to do it in a hurry. And Brandon, my chief assistant here, is very quick on his feet. He got me from hall to hall. It's the only time I've ever used a wheelchair. And Jim Mosley says that I'm confined to a wheelchair. And he also said, you know, at 81, Randi hasn't got long to live. Yeah, like, come on, let's get real here. Jim himself is 78,
right.
So I guess he thinks he's got forever to live. But hey, what can I do? You can't talk sense to these people.
Yeah, actually, I read his book, Confessions of a Grave Robber, or something. I think it is.
Yes, indeed.
It was entertaining, although interesting kind of guy. I mean, he says that. Yeah,
oh, yes.
He robbed graves down in South America, and
so he was a ghoul.
Well, for artifacts.
No, he was a huaquero. That's what they call people who in Spanish in Peru. That's the terminology they use, huaquero. And He didn't mention my name, I suppose, in the book.
Not that I recall. It's been a number of years since I read it.
Well, you I think you would recall, because I actually accompanied him on one of his forays in Peru. I found it very interesting, and I came back with a couple of small pocket pieces, very tiny little figurines. It's all over the desert there. It's strewn all over the Atacama Desert there, which is the longest desert in the world, by the way. And, yes, it's strewn all over the place. It's quite an adventure, because you can find skulls and things that the wind just uncovers.
Cool. Oh, Bob's on his way now. he's getting a ticket as we speak.
I see. Okay.
Randy, you said he was your ex-friend, so like you were chums at the time,
well,
but
no,
you were falling out?
He fell out with me somehow, and I don't know what it was all about. I can't recall now, but somehow he was saying that I was denying the existence of UFOs, which I've never done. I've just said I'm denying the evidence of UFOs. I'm very careful about those statements. But he eventually changed his mind, did Jim, and he decided that it was all a crock, and he used another expression, actually, and that he just sort of went along with it because it was sort of fun to follow the cuckoos, and the cuckoos have been dying at an alarming rate, and I guess we're the only two that are left. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that was kind of the impression I got from his book, is that he was being kind of coy, not really saying if he believes or doesn't believe, but it was all kind of fun. So I guess subsequently he's been more emphatically saying, yeah, there's no evidence for UFOs. I mean, is he taking that position now?
Yeah, more or less. It's hard to tell with Jim.
So, Randy, I know that you've been working on your latest book, A Magician in the Laboratory. How's that going?
Very well, very well. The problem, Steve, is that, and gentlemen, I should say, the problem is that I've got so much material, and I've got 32 chapters so far that are not all written, but I've got the material assembled for them. And, you know, the computer is a blessing this way, if I can use that term loosely. I don't know how I'd do it without it. The other books I did with paste-ups, you know, I would type out entire pages and then cut them up with scissors and glue them together and then photocopy them and send them off. It must have been a pain. Now, anyway, yes, it's far from completion. It's going to be probably two-thirds of the way through next year before I actually have it in shape to send to a publisher. Mm-hmm. I won't have any problem getting a publisher, because once you have a few successful books that have some copies,
Can you give us any anecdotes from the book? Give us a taste of what it's going to be about?
I've got, well, as I say, 32 chapters. One of the very big ones is going to be on the Benveniste affair, which is homeopathy, of course. That he's the only person, Jacques Benveniste in France, who supported the whole homeopathy picture. And he is the only man in history to win two Ig Nobel Prizes. Yes. And that's a distinction. You can't beat that.
It's quite an honor, yeah.
You've got to be really stupid to get that. But he is now deceased and also dead. And unfortunately, an accident during a brain operation, as a matter of fact. I don't know what was happening to him. But, you know, I was never enemies with him. He wrote me up very badly on a couple of sites there and accused me of all kinds of dreadful things. That is... In the academic direction, but then I got out on the excuse that I'm not an academic. I only have a degree from the University of Indianapolis in humane letters, and I don't even know what the letters are. It'd be only H or E, I'm not sure. But one of these days I may find out.
I thought he died from a homeopathic overdose.
No, that means you have to stop taking it altogether, because the deeper the dilution of the thing, like 10 to the 30th or 10 to the 60th, which is well over Avogadro's limit, the more powerful the medicine is. So he forgot to take it one day and died.
Or, Bob, did you mean that he fell in a swimming pool, you know, and couldn't get out?
Yeah, right.
That way.
Yeah, that's true, true. Any glass of water is going to have all the homeopathic charm that all of it has.
I wish that homeopathy died with Jacques Benveniste, but it hasn't. I mean, now, that's one of the ones that amazes me, that it still is chugging along. Yeah. And now, I don't know if you... been following some of the blogs, we've been talking about the fact that the Huffington Post has now hired Dana Ullman as a regular blogger, and he is an apologist for homeopathy. He's just embarrassing. Yes. I don't know if you've ever crossed swords with him.
He's an embarrassing human being, let alone an advocate of homeopathy. No, he's just, it's at the point I think he's just stupid. Mm-hmm. I think I have to give him the benefit of the doubt and call him stupid. I don't think he's a nefarious person or anything like that. But his whole profession is based on homeopathy, so he has to defend it. And that gives him a good motive to promote it, of course. But I think he's just basically a stupid man.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the way that creationists say are, in that they have they're in an impossible position. They have to defend something which is wrong.
Yeah,
and it's amazing the mental gymnastics Dana Ullman goes through, cherry picking data and making ridiculous correlations between things. It really is just astounding.
Yeah, and the point is that he can ignore all the negative stuff by choosing carefully, as you say, cherry picking, of course. But to him, I think he thinks it's okay.
Yeah.
Because basically the phenomenon is there, you see. That's his belief. I think he really honestly believes that it works and that it exists as a chemical phenomenon, or I don't know how you could describe it, really.
Yeah, he's pushing the water memory thing now, and he will link to evidence that has absolutely nothing to do with homeopathy and doesn't support it and say, see, there's something funny going on with water. That means homeopathy can work.
That sounds like Rumston Roy, right?
Oh, yeah, he and Rumston Roy are buddies. I mean, that's absolutely. Again, Roy has been promoting this water memory thing, which is really absurd, right? Because they're pointing to these very transient effects, and which does not in any way rescue homeopathy from being pure vitalistic magic.
Well, you know, on Swift, you wanted something that's going to come out of a new book, A Magician in the Laboratory. I can give you a good sample of something, I think.
Okay.
I have been fighting the NIH now, tooth and nail, because I belong to the Gildas Group. You know what Gildas Group is all about? Gildas Place, I should say. It's named after Gilda Radner, who left a sizable fortune to open branches all over the country. And people with cancer problems go there, recovering or in the middle of it or whatever. They go there for advice and camaraderie. And I it's just down the street from me here, not more than 200 yards. And so I walk down, and I spend a lot of my time there in the evening just sitting and holding people's hands and cheering them up, because they're feeling very sorry for themselves, and rightly so. They have a right to it, I guess. One of the things that I'm writing about in Magician in the Laboratory is the fact that acupuncture is being promoted, tacitly promoted, I add that very carefully, please, by the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. Now, that is $120 billion a year, something they're funding. It's just incredible. And it's paid for by taxpayers and also some generous donors out there, of course. Now, they have 520 references to experiments to examine whether acupuncture works on their webpage, on the NIH webpage. You can go to it, see 520 of them. Now, I have a fellow in England who has gone through the first 240 or so far, doing an analysis of them as to whether or not they're valid. A lot of them are in Chinese, so we can't read them at all, so we just count those out. But we've got certain classifications. Eight out of the ones that he's examined already, as I say, something like 240, 280, whatever it is, eight of them are positive, but none of the eight were done double blind.
Mm-hmm.
And in most of them, they mention, no, it's not necessary. When you're testing acupuncture to do the double, it's the most necessary thing. No experiment is valid unless it's double blind. If it can be double blinded, so it's just not valid. And so none of the eight of the winners, and most of them are incomplete. They don't. They just have the abstract. They don't have the entire paper, and the entire paper runs on forever and ever over the hill, as you can imagine. When and if you can find it. So far, they're not doing too well in the stuff they've offered. Now, I know what the NIH did, I'm sure. They just said to some student, they said, go into Google and go into Yahoo and pick up everything you can on experiments that have been done to examine the efficacy of acupuncture. And they've done that, and they've just listed all of them as if they were positive. And you go through them, and it's negative, 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 or the usual thing, they only had 40 subjects or something. And you can't get a database on 40 subjects of something like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this is, I think, because the NIH has now the National Center for Complementary Alternative Medicine as one of its centers, which was sort of forced down their throats by the Senate. But, you know, I think Harkin was mainly behind that. And so now there's basically a foothold of complementary alternative medicine proponents who are using the prestige of the NIH to promote treatments which don't work, like acupuncture. And then they're using this, you know, in my opinion, very deceptive mechanisms to try to make it seem as if it's legitimate. But as you say, I mean, what your colleague is doing is replicating what has already been done with specific questions. There have been systematic reviews of acupuncture evidence for specific indications, and they're all negative. Whenever you take, all right, what's all the evidence for acupuncture and back pain? You look at all the evidence, you look at the quality of the studies, which ones are positive, which ones were negative. They're negative. Overall, the evidence is. If there weren't a political
agenda
behind it, if this were just another in a regular medical modality, it would have been discarded a long time ago.
Well, you'll get a big kick out of this. I did write an email to the NIH asking them, what is your view on the use of acupuncture for treatment of cancer and for the side effects of chemotherapy that I'm currently undergoing? Because even the local clinic here told me, did you think of trying acupuncture? And I blew up and gave them the complete lecture, and believe me, in high dudgeon. And I get in high dudgeon, that's much different from my low dudgeon, very much.
Did you say, do you know who I am? Do you look at me?
Examination of those 520 papers is proving very, very interesting, because I got my first hints by examining all the NIH pamphlets that I could find, and Gilda's place has lots of them on the rack, as you can imagine. The usual mention is something like, you may wish to speak to your physician concerning the use of acupuncture for relief of these side effects. Mm-hmm. Now, that is saying nothing. It's a tacit approval.
Right.
The fact is that it is an approval because people read these leaflets and they see NIH approves it.
Right.
And all of the acupuncturists, I went in for an MRI the other day, Steve, mm-hmm. because I had a problem with the right arm and everything, and they wanted to know if it was neurological or whatever. Anyway, then I saw the place was littered with acupuncture brochures. The guy who runs the machine, this is a technician now, is also a doctor of acupuncture,
mm-hmm.
and he advertises his wares on there, and he publishes in those leaflets 59 diseases that acupuncture is used to treat, so he says, and he uses the mention at the top, approved by the NIH.
Of course.
And of course, I sent them copies of these things and saying, is this claim correct or not? Now, they won't answer me. The answer I did get when I sent an email to the NIH, back in I sat here and I roared with laughter, and everyone wondered what was wrong with the old guy in the office there. It said that they have examined the needles that are used for the typical acupuncture treatment, and they are sharp and stainless steel, and they can be sterilized, and they are discardable. Now, that's exactly like saying to a guy who says, goes to NASA and says, I want to go up on the shuttle and repair the toilet they've been having problems with. Oh, are you a plumber? Of course I'm a plumber. Look, I have a Stilson wrench.
Mm-hmm.
Stilson wrench are the best in trade, you see. So naturally, what else do you need to know? They use sharp needles. That's what the NIH was saying. They use sharp needles. That's the proof.
Well, I run into that a lot, because FDA approves the needles as being acceptable medical devices. That's not the same thing as approving the use of any of those needles.
That's right. Or the effect, the possible effect of them. It says nothing to that effect at all.
Yes, but people will advertise FDA approved, but they're really just talking about in some very narrow sense that has nothing to do with the actual clinical claims that are being made.
It's like when you see on electrical devices and hardware, so URRL or whatever it is, approved. Underwood is laboratory, approved. It's approved for use, but it doesn't mean that it does what it does.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it's safe. You can use this thing without dying.
Not gonna kill you.
You could see how savvy they've become in finding every possible way of trying to surround themselves with the trappings of legitimacy without ever having actually earned it through evidence.
Very true. Now, Susan Summers, of course, made an announcement just the other day when I was in the midst of the chemo infusion. I turned on the television, and she was there on Oprah Winfrey, was it? I think it was Oprah Winfrey.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and she was saying that chemotherapy has been proven to be total nonsense. So I yanked the needle out of my arm, of course, because you know what kind of an authority she is. She's an actress, and of course, yes, she knows everything. Her medical training is profound.
Oh, Suzanne Somers, man, don't get me started on her. So she recently said that Patrick Swayze, you know, who died recently, that she said he died because of the chemotherapy.
That's right.
Then she had to apologize for it.
Of course, Oprah just fawns over her like crazy. Oprah is one of the most dangerous women in history, let alone in this generation.
Thank you. Yes, we've been saying that for quite some time now.
Absolutely, because she gives the platform for every crank and charlatan that's out there.
She's the loudspeaker. She's the amplifier. No doubt. She takes something that's terrible and makes it 100 times worse.
And makes it apparently acceptable to a lot of little ladies who are sitting there in their rocking chairs and watching, and they'll go out and buy the book.
Yeah, she's basically our nemesis, I think, Oprah Winfrey. So, Randy, I like asking those people who have been in the skeptical movement longer than I have, how you think we are doing on the whole. You have a perspective that obviously is more far-reaching than ours. So how do you think we're doing?
I think we're doing okay, Steve. The feedback I get is very satisfactory. I get the cuckoo stuff, the woo-woo stuff. I'm promoting that word, woo-woo. I want to get that into Webster's. And if we use it enough, and it spreads around, it's going to be in my new book on almost every page, I'm sure. I think we're doing well because I get a lot of mail from people who are congratulating me on what I'm doing and letters that read like this kind of thing. You know, when I first heard of you, Mr. Randy, I was very opposed to you. Then I looked at one of your books in the library, or I bought the book, which is much more satisfactory, and I found out that you were right. I had a lawyer friend. I don't know whether I ever told you this story. A fellow walked in the door unannounced with a briefcase in his hand. He was on his way to hear a case a couple of blocks down in the courthouse. And he happened by, and he came in, and we greeted him, and he wanted to have a word with me. And he opened up his briefcase and took out a tattered, really tattered copy of Flim Flam. I love to see those artifacts. And it had yellow slips all the way on all three openings on the book. He said, this is my copy of Flim Flam, which I started to examine. He said, but note something, if you will, and he handed it to me. And I saw that it was only two-thirds of the way full of yellow slips. He said, yes, I stopped two-thirds of the way through because I was wasting yellow slips. I looked in the mirror and I said, damn, the man's right. Mm-hmm. He said, I hated you. I hated you because you were destroying some of my favorite ideas on this sort of thing, see? But he said, I got to that point, and I gave up, and he said, I'm here to buy another copy of Flim Flam. If you make a difference, if it turns people around in their tracks and makes them think, I don't ask them to believe what I say. I always say, don't believe me saying it, you know? Examine what I'm saying and find out for yourself whether you consider it to be more reasonable than a previous attitude. And he apparently did that, and he was very happy with the results. And when they announced it to you, like, damn, I mean, my chest really hung out there. You know, it was something to see me. I was unbearable for 2 days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But by the way, I did a quick search, and woo-woo is in the Urban Dictionary.
Oh, really? Woo-woo?
Woo-woo.
Oh, really?
Descriptive of an event or person espousing New Age theories such as energy work, crystal magic, Reiki, etc. Or a gullible person is the second definition. However, it's not in the Webster's online dictionary. Mm-hmm. So you made the Urban Dictionary, but not yet Webster's Dictionary.
Well, I'm aiming for Webster's. I always like Noah. Nice old fellow.
But getting back to what you were saying, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think we get those emails as well. I think that we certainly can have an impact on the individual level.
Yeah, exactly.
But what do you think? How do you think we're doing in sort of broader culture? The perception of skeptics within culture, our penetration, our effect on the media. Do you feel it's different than it was, say, 20 years ago?
I don't think we're having much effect on the media, unfortunately, because the media is not interested in truth. They're interested in effect. And if something comes out where homeopathy has saved some young girl's life, they'll publish that, and the criticism, they'll call me for a comment on the thing. And I know damn well they're going to change it, or they're not going to use it at all.
I agree. We've encountered that too. You have the reporters or the media outlets that write the story first and then backfill the investigation just to fill in the needed details. But they already know what the story is. They're not actually doing any investigation.
And you know what happens, and they'll say something like, wait a minute, we need an opposing view in here.
Yeah.
Because it's got to be fair. But that's not fair at all when they hardly use it or they change it so much.
Well, it's token. Yeah, just token skepticism.
Yes, indeed.
But at the same time, like, there was just a in Wired magazine, which is actually a pretty well-circulated online magazine, ran a cover story on autism and vaccines that was hard-nosed skeptical. It really was a great article.
It was excellent. It was great.
So, I think we're penetrating, and there. Yeah,
we're getting there, Steve. We are getting there. Aside from the personal mail that I get and such, I meet people in the street. I meet people in restaurants and in taxi cabs when I share sometimes from the airport and on planes all the time. Anyone who recognizes me will usually come over and say something. Of course, I don't know what the people who snarl at me as they pass by. I don't hear snarls very well. So maybe just as many people pass by me who hate my guts. But yeah, we're getting there. We're making an impression. And if we keep the latest amazing meetings that we've had in London and in Las Vegas, 1,007 people in Las Vegas. And I'm very buoyed by that, I must say.
Well, Randy, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I'm glad to hear that you're doing so well.
Well, I'm happy to hear from you, Steve. Always happy to hear from you, of course. And or to see you, as I occasionally do. It's our paths do cross in the skeptical world. And I assure all of your listeners that I am doing very well with the chemo. It's not bothering me at all. Well, making me extremely weak, and I do a lot of napping. But at 81, I do a lot of napping anyway.
But we're all amazed at how active and spry you are, even through all of this. So you're an inspiration.
And that's why they called me Randy.
Well, thanks again, Randy. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Randy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you all ready for this week?
Yes.
Red October standing by.
This is a bye week for Rebecca. Here we go. Item number one. New research finds that diabetes is a major risk factor for developing schizophrenia, which may result from the effects of insulin on the brain. Item number two, researchers found the testosterone levels of men who voted for John McCain or Robert Barr in the 2009 presidential election dropped significantly after hearing the results of the election. Item number three, geologists have identified an alternate candidate crater for the KT extinction event off the coast of India, and if confirmed, would have resulted from a meteor four times as large as the one that caused the Yucatan crater. Evan, go first.
A major risk factor for developing schizophrenia, that diabetes is, resulting from the effects of insulin on the brain. I don't know. Major risk factor? I thought the major risk factor of developing schizophrenia was genetics. The genes you are passed along. I don't know about that one. And then researchers found testosterone levels of men who voted for McCain and Barr dropped significantly after hearing the results. I guess so. I mean, there's nothing implausible about that. They must have had these people volunteered for that specific study. It's an interesting study in a way.
And incidentally, for those who don't recall, John McCain and Robert Barr lost that election.
No? What? I demand a recount. Did they also have, the men who voted for Obama on that? I'm curious. It's interesting. I think that one is science. And now this one. An alternate candidate crater for the KT extinction off the coast of India. Sure, yeah, why not? I mean, because you can identify a candidate, and maybe it was four times, it would have been four times as large. That doesn't mean it was it. They still have to confirm it, like you said, so that one seems plausible to me. I don't know about this major risk factor that you're describing about insulin on the brain for its developing schizophrenia. That one doesn't sit right with me. So I'll say that one is fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see, another alternate candidate for KT. Wow, that's pretty interesting that they would find another potential crater that could have caused the dinosaur extinction 65 million years ago. Four times as large, that would be a huge, huge meteor over 20 miles. Wow. Wow, what an event that would be.
Boom.
the testosterone dropping for supporters of McCain. Yeah, I can kind of see that. You get really bummed by something like that. I could see how it would have an effect on testosterone, but significantly dropped? I don't know. And then the diabetes one, major risk factor for. I would have thought that would have been discovered quite a while ago if that were the case. Not something that would just seems odd that they would only notice that now. Insulin on the brain. That doesn't sound right to me. I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Steve, do you know what the diameter of the Yucatan crater is? Because I'm trying to figure out, like, if this thing in India was four times the size, then I actually think that would be too big. That something that size would have actually done a lot more damage, would have done too much damage. You know, if something, you know, big enough hits the earth, it could crack the actual mantle, and that's a deal killer. I don't know. So I just don't know enough about how big this what this proposed hit was. I don't know. I don't know about that one. I don't know. Researchers found the testosterone levels dropped after people found out that John McCain or Robert Barr lost. That's pretty interesting. I mean, I guess that's plausible. I mean, I don't know what it's interesting to think that your emotion could affect your testosterone level dramatically or quickly. But that's I suppose that's plausible. And new research finds that diabetes could be linked to schizophrenia. That's another one of those things. I'm sure it's plausible. So when you're a diabetic, you don't process insulin properly, right?
You're resistant to insulin. Type 2 diabetes, yeah.
So that would mean that you have too much insulin?
Yeah. Yeah, type 1 diabetes, you don't make insulin because something has wiped out the cells in your pancreas that makes the insulin. Type 2 diabetes, you make too much insulin because you're resistant to the insulin. The insulin doesn't have as much of an effect as it's supposed to have.
Okay, so this is going under type 2 diabetes,
yeah,
which means that too much insulin could have an effect on your brain. That's really interesting. I bet you – I don't know. I think that one is definitely science. I don't know about the testosterone one. That's, I don't know. I'm sure it's possible. I just don't know enough about it, but it just – something about that one seems kind of strange to me. But I just don't think that this whole thing with the KT extinction – something four times as large as a Yucatan crater. I think that one is the fake.
Okay. Well, we'll start in the middle then. You all agree that researchers found the testosterone levels of men who voted for John McCain or Robert Barr in the 2009 presidential election dropped significantly after hearing the results of the election. And that one is science. Not surprising. They did compare it to those who voted for Obama, whose levels fell only a little bit. Mainly because it was in the evening and, you know, levels tend to fall later in the day anyway. So the levels for the Obama voters fell just slightly, as you would predict, just from the time of day. But the McCain and Barr supporters dropped significantly by about 25%.
So why did that happen?
Well, the thinking is that, you know, testosterone obviously is a hormone of aggression in men. This is actually, as I said, only in males. And it's tied to contests. So the similar findings have been found for, you know, men after losing a competition, or if we lose a competition through a proxy, right? So if your team loses, you know, you have the same kind of reduction in testosterone. So this extrapolates even to something, a team kind of a contest, even into politics, like who you support for president.
I find this curious because it makes me think that, you know, maybe we evolved this to kind of be more subservient when we've been bested or when we've been dominated.
Exactly. That is the standard interpretation, that it's a dominance competition kind of thing, and when you lose, it kind of puts you into a more subservient mood. It's easy to see what the advantage would be, that if you've been bested in a competition, but you're still hopped up on testosterone, you know, you then may provoke the enemy that has clearly bested you. So it's probably a survival advantage to calm down at that point and to shift more into a subservient way of behaving.
Ah.
Right. But it's just interesting that this extrapolates even to political fights, right? Let's go on to the third one. Geologists have identified an alternate candidate crater for the KT extinction event off the coast of India, and if confirmed, would have resulted from a meteor four times as large as the one that caused the Yucatan crater. Jay, you think this one's a fiction. Bob and Evan, you think this one is science. And this one is science.
Science.
Sorry, Jay.
Groovy. Yeah, science.
Yeah, I found this a little surprising. You know, this is they're claiming this is a pretty darn big crater. This is the Shiva crater. Its outer rim forms a rough faulted ring some 500 kilometers in diameter. They estimate that if this is confirmed as a meteor crater, that the bolide that struck would have been about 40 kilometers or 25 miles in diameter.
Wow.
Compared to the Yucatan strike, which was 8 to 10 kilometers or 5 to 6.2 miles wide. So, yeah, this would be about four times bigger.
And they've dated it to approximately the same time, though? I mean,
yeah, well, they still need to confirm that. They think that it would date to the KT boundary, but the researchers need to do on some on-site investigation and confirm that there's shocked quartz in the basin, that there's an iridium anomaly, that it has the features, in other words, of an actual meteor strike and not something else that happened, like a supervolcano or something or whatever. They said this would have cracked the crust, it would have had its own tectonics, basically, would have resulted in, you know, secondary volcanic-type eruptions. This was a cataclysmic event. So whenever if it is a strike, whenever it happened,
yeah,
caused some badness.
But wouldn't it be too big?
I mean, we'll see. I mean, it has to be more thoroughly analyzed. It wouldn't necessarily be, you know, de facto too big an impact. It would have been, again, cataclysmic, you know, the kind of thing that would cause a mass extinction, but not necessarily like wipe out all life on Earth kind of thing. So if this really is an impact crater, what I find interesting is that, you know, then what about the Yucatan one? You know, if it'd be interesting to see what the date is. What if this dates to the KT, just like the Yucatan strike? I mean, what does that mean? One of them's wrong? There were two strikes? Is this a meteor that broke apart and hit in two places? I don't know. What does that mean?
Or was it part of some sort of asteroid storm where the two
– maybe.
Imagine two hitting within, yeah, you know – within centuries of each other or even closer.
But if you recall, there's been, you know, we've analyzed the fossil strata from around the world, and it really
right.
does seem to zero in like a bullseye on the Yucatan strike. So I don't,
yeah,
honestly, I don't buy this.
Yeah.
I think it's either not a meteor strike or it dates to some other time. I'd be very surprised if the Yucatan strike data turns out not to be true, because that seems pretty solid to me.
Yeah, my guess is that it's going to be another time.
Because
the shape of the crater is pretty classic. I mean, I don't think it's much easier, I think, to make a mistake on the timing at this stage of the game than the actual shape of it. Because, man, it sure looks like a crater.
Right. So we'll see. All of this means that new research finds that diabetes is a major risk factor for developing schizophrenia, which may result from the effects of insulin on the brain, is complete fiction. It's nothing to do with diabetes, nothing to do with insulin. So just wipe that from your memory. However, I did get this from a real news item. They linking risk for the development of schizophrenia to the treatment with certain anti-epileptic drugs. Now, this is an animal study looking at the effect of certain anti-epileptic drugs on critical, given, you know, during critical periods of brain development on an animal model that increases schizophrenia-like behaviors. So, you know, mental illness is always hard to model in an animal, right? Because they just don't have the behaviors that humans do. So this is, you know, for, you know, schizophrenia-like behaviors in an animal, it's something, but it's hard to know what that really means. But this is concerning, and this definitely needs follow-up research. So drugs like phenobarbital and other drugs that are used to treat seizures, we know these are heavy-duty, you know, brain-altering drugs. I mean, they have an effect on neurotransmitters and brain cell function. That's how they work. They are used to prevent seizures from occurring, and seizures have negative effects as well. So, you know, there's always a risk versus benefit. And there's been concerns for a long time with giving these drugs to children, especially during, you know, periods of brain development, because the concern is that it would inhibit neuronal function and brain development and may adversely affect the IQ of children who are treated for seizures with these drugs. And you know, if this pans out, and I think you know, we would need to follow up with some epidemiological studies and see if there's a higher incidence of schizophrenia or other mental illnesses in people who were treated with certain drugs at certain ages. You know, that would then have to be added to the risk end of the equation. Still, you know, it's hard to know what to do if you have a 3-year-old who's seizing every day. You got to do something, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the risk of not treating is huge in situations that you think that's not good for brain development either. So, good job, Bob and Evan.
Thanks, Doc.
Who's that noisy?
Evan, tell us about last week's Who's That Noisy?
Yeah, last week's Who's That Noisy. I guess I should pull that up and have a look. Let us take a moment and replay the fascinating noise that was last week's Who's That Noisy.
So what was that noisy, Evan?
That was an emperor penguin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can believe that. And a lot of people actually got that.
Yeah, I reckon. I mean, if you saw the movie March of the Penguins, you probably would recognize that.
I saw the movie and I didn't recognize it, but that penguin sounded pretty pissed off.
Or even Happy Feet. See Happy Feet?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't have kids.
Oh, right.
I did. That was a wild. That was a pretty.
I
wild
like that
sounding.
Movie.
Oh my God, Steve! You're getting so weak in your old age.
Come on, Happy Feet. Dancing penguins. What's not to love?
Could you not? Yeah, right.
I mean, certainly the experience of watching the movie is different when you're watching your children watch the movie.
All right. Okay. Anyway, here we
and
go.
And the winner was Reitstoen, Reitstoen, from the message boards.
Good job.
Congratulations.
Did he say penguin or emperor penguin? Because I think this some for this
he said
one,
emperor penguins.
Okay. Yeah. I think you have to get. Yeah, they have to name the actual species. A lot of people I saw said penguins. Like,
yeah.
For this one, you got to get it exact.
Yeah. Come on, people.
And let's enact the same rule for this week's.
Okay.
Who's that noisy? Okay. Here is this week's Who's That Noisy?
Well, thank you, Evan.
Well, anytime.
It's turned out to be quite a fun segment.
It is a good segment.
Jay, finish us off with a quote.
I have a quote sent in by Rob Taylor from Wake Forest, North Carolina, from one of your favorite people, Steve, Christopher Hitchens.
Chris Hitchens.
He's one of mine, too. Don't leave me out of this.
We all like him.
I remember before I really started doing a lot of reading about Christopher Hitchens and getting into him, Steve actually said, oh, my God, Jay, he's one of my heroes. And that really inspired me to learn all about this guy, and he is awesome. Anyway, Christopher Hitchens said, doubt, skepticism, innovation, and inquiry are the only means by which wonder, beauty, awe, and symmetry will be discovered. Christopher Hitchens!
It's a nice quote.
Hitch, as he's known to his friends. Hello, Hitch. How are you?
Well, Jay, you have an announcement to make?
Yeah, Travis Roy from the Granite State Skeptics will be doing an investigation of an allegedly haunted location on Halloween night from 8 to 10 p.m. So what they're going to do is they'll be Twittering live, and you can follow along at twitter.com/GSSkeptics. That's for Granite State Skeptics. And if the technology permits, they said they'll be doing streaming live video as well. And right after they finish up on that investigation, they'll be meeting at midnight at the Hannah Dustin Memorial in Boscawen, New Hampshire, to go over the results and taking questions. Travis is a good guy. I'm sure they're going to have a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's always fun.
But they're not going to stay up for the witching hours?
I wouldn't doubt that they're going to stay up really late and get kooky.
Oh, you got to stay up late until you start hallucinating from sleep deprivation. That's when the ghosts come
that's
out.
That's right. Around 3 o'clock in the morning, according to Ed Warren. Right. I mean, that's the best time when you're half asleep and you know your brain
absolutely
starts taking over.
Start to get some.
You see all kinds of
hypnagogia
things.
Kicks in. It's awesome.
Oh, forget about it. It's the
thanks everyone for joining me this week.
Shirley.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Always a good time.
It was fun.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.